Ave, listeners. If you've ever wanted to see myself and Rhiannon on stage in a live recording of Emperors of Rome, well, now is your chance. We're finally going to be holding one in Melbourne, Australia. It's at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, 22nd of November. We'll be talking about Cleopatra, her political ambitions, and how she's more than just Caesar and Mark Antony. Tickets are free, and you can get them now at the Wheeler Centre website. Hope to see you there. And now... Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LVII, Little Soul, Little Wanderer, Little Charmer. When we last left Hadrian, he had wandered to every province of the Roman Empire. He'd spent a lot of time in Greece, he'd waged a war against the Jews... And oh, in amongst all that, he'd find time to rule the Roman Empire. With his health now failing, he withdraws to seclusion in his own villa. He tries to find a successor who can carry on as the next emperor, and he lashes out against anybody who displeases him. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Towards the end of his life, Hadrian seems to have had various disagreements with people, and quite a tetchy sort of end the last few years. There are certainly a sort of upswing in executions and arguments and spats with people. Probably this is partly because there's a certain amount of tension about who he's going to name as his heir. But also he, being quite ill by this point, the last 3 years of his life, he is just ill. He's dying. He probably was not in a good frame of mind himself. And this leads to Hadrian ending up, for example, with the Augustan history, having a very bad reputation, partly because of the number of people that he gets rid of and has arguments with right towards the end.
All right, so let's start with one person that he's had arguments with, who he name-dropped in the last episode. This is my good buddy Apollodorus of Damascus. He's a really famous architect during that period and has a great reputation from the time of Trajan, when he was likely a favourite. He designed the Forum of Trajan and Trajan's Column, and also the bridge across the Danube. So he's got a reputation of, if you're building something, go and talk to Apollodorus. But he's not, he kind of falls out of favor though with Hadrian, doesn't he?
Well, according to Dio, there was always tension, even during the reign of Trajan. Hadrian himself had some aspirations towards being a designer and you know, having ideas that he wanted to put forward in terms of architecture. And Apollodorus was quite slighting of him, of course, not knowing at that point that he was going to become emperor. I can imagine him creeping up to Trajan and Apollodorus as they're looking at the important work of designing this great, beautiful forum that Apollodorus is building for Trajan. And Hadrian put some ideas forward, which presumably involved perhaps building domes or something circular, to which Apollodorus is supposed to have replied, "Be off and draw pumpkins. You don't understand any of these matters." So he just sort of sweeps him away with this very offhand statement.
So he's being dismissive of a little kid here, isn't he?
Basically, a young man, certainly,
okay.
Saying that you don't know anything about these important grown-up matters.
But unfortunately for Apollodorus, being dismissive of who turns out to be the next emperor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And remember that Hadrian gets adopted very late on in the process, so nobody's absolutely certain that he's going to be the next emperor. Now, presumably, Hadrian and Apollodorus would have had some dealings, or there's the potential that they had some dealings early on in Hadrian's reign, because Trajan's Forum is still being completed at this time, and the temple of the deified Trajan is in the Forum. And of course, that's not built by Trajan, because he's not deified till after he's dead. So if Apollodorus had any hand in that, then they were still working together in some way.
There's also a couple of question marks over who built the Pantheon, and there's a train of thought that it was Apollodorus.
Although that would have been the pumpkinification that he was apparently putting down, if we believe Dio's statement.
Wow, shout out to Seneca references.
Because it's the biggest dome in the world.
Yeah.
How much prestige would have been wrapped up in designing that?
Dubious, and so how do we know that there was a real problem then between Apollodorus and Hadrian, besides that reference that
it continues to be along the lines of who knows how to design things properly.
Okay.
And we still have the same passage of Dio from book 69. Hadrian puts forward designs for the massive temple that he builds in the heart of Rome, which is the Temple of Venus and Roma, very close to the Colosseum. Apollodorus puts this down as well. He points out several flaws with this temple, apparently, that it should have been made higher up to allow for storage for the Colosseum beneath it. It would have stood out more if it had been on a higher podium. Now, if you go to Rome today and you walk down the part of the Sacred Way that goes past the Arch of Titus out towards the Colosseum, it just towers above you. The podium is massive.
Mm.
So I find these statements in Dio a bit dubious, really, particularly because the other, perhaps more famous statement, and at least pithy statement Apollodorus is meant to have made, is that the cult statues of Venus and Roma would not have fitted into their respective sanctuaries. So there's a place inside a temple called the Cella, which is where the god lives, and that's where you put their statue. And these were seated statues of goddesses. And Apollodorus said, well, if they want to get out, they're going to knock their heads against the ceiling, because seated, they're so massive. If they stand up, they'll be in trouble. Their heads will come through
so
the roof.
So he's got a problem with scale.
Yeah, look, it's a great story. Unfortunately, that is the Greek tradition, to have massive seated statues of gods. Mm. So if you think about, if anybody's ever seen a reconstruction, we don't have it, of the statue that was in the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, which is the basis for the statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial, where he's just seated, looking very kind of self-assured with his hands on each of the arms of the throne. That's huge, and yet it's seated. And that seems to have been quite typical of the kind of cult statue you would have in Greek temples, which, of course, is exactly what would appeal to Hadrian, because he loves those Greek styles. So it's not surprising he would do that. So whether Apollodorus would actually criticize him for that, maybe he would if he just wanted to get at him for every little thing. Well, but the thing is, it's not a Hadrianic innovation.
There seems to be a problem of tone, though. When he wrote this so bluntly to Hadrian, the latter was both vexed and exceedingly pained, because he had fallen into a mistake that could not be set right.
Mm.
He restrained neither his anger nor his grief, but murdered the man.
Yes, he had Apollodorus executed.
Yeah.
And the only reason we're given here in Dio, which is one of our more reliable sources, is that he felt very peevish with him for critiquing his designs. So, you know, the next time somebody isn't entirely happy with your work, just get them bumped off, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
And you would if you were Hadrian.
Constructive feedback, people. Okay, so whether there are elements of that that are or are not accurate, it does kind of, in some ways, characterize this period of Hadrian's life, doesn't he? Because Apollodorus isn't the only one to suffer such a fate.
No, it's pretty extreme fate just for disagreeing over the design of buildings.
Yeah.
But yes, he's not the only one. There are lots of high-profile Romans at this point who are unfortunate enough to displease Hadrian.
Mm.
Some of those, indeed, will be the ones put forward as his successors.
Yeah, it kind of bookends his reign almost as well.
Yes, it does,
it?
Exactly. And this is one of the things people have discussed, is that he kind of starts badly. There are, you know, senators he gets rid of. Then he seems to be this very conciliatory kind of emperor, until perhaps we get to the uprising in Judea and the aftermath of that back in Rome, that the end of his life is very bloodthirsty.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about succession now, because it seems to tie in with that to some extent. Who, from Rome's perspective, is the most likely successor if you're going for closest relations?
Hadrian doesn't have any younger relations who seem obvious to him as successors. And in fact, the person that for a time people think will be the successor is surprisingly someone who's older but is married to Hadrian's sister. And he's called Lucius Iulius Ursus Servianus. He's had a long senatorial career, which stretches all the way back to Nerva. So he's served as a consul several times. And he is somebody who, you know, obviously, therefore, has a good rapport with the Senate. But he's about 30 years older than Hadrian. So that in itself could be seen as problematic, because he's almost 90 towards the end of Hadrian's life. Hadrian therefore seems to have shown some favour towards Servianus's grandson, who is of a more viable age to actually succeed him. He was called Fuscus, which means the dark person. And dark in that kind of shadowy, secretive sort of way.
Not even back then.
Yeah.
He has black hair.
Yeah, it probably started from that.
He's got a tan complexion.
almost certainly. Even he may not have, but somebody in his family was given that name because of that. But this did not come to pass because both of them are executed, both grandfather Servianus and grandson Fuscus in 137. He may have suspected them of mounting a coup.
Yeah.
This is something we've seen throughout the imperial period that happens from time to time. Although it hasn't happened much in recent history that we've been looking at. And we don't know. We know they were both executed. A coup or an attempted coup is usually a viable reason.
Yeah.
Whether it was the case here, we don't have very firm evidence from Dio or the Augustan history.
We do get some interesting last words, don't we, attributed to Servianus that come up in Dio.
Yes, just before execution, he asks for fire, which is something that you need to carry out a religious ritual. So you need it for sacrifices.
Not just last words. This is...
Yeah, that he's...
A curse.
It makes it something very formal and I guess, in the eyes of the gods, because he gets incense as well, which is something that you offer to the gods. And he's supposed to have exclaimed, this is in Dio, that I am guilty of no wrong, O gods, you are well aware. As for Hadrian, this is my only prayer, that he may long for death, but be unable to die.
Okay, that's a bit foretelling, and we'll come back to that, I suppose. Let's just leave that pause there. So Servianus is put to death. Fuscus is put to death. Hadrian has no real living heirs and a very kind of probably angry Rome at the death of these two.
Well, certainly the senatorial body would not have been happy with this event.
So who is Hadrian's second choice then, I suppose, once he stops favouring Fuscus?
Well, he's someone that goes by the great name of Lucius Caonius Commodus. Do not confuse him with the Emperor Commodus who's coming up in a few generations.
So this decision he makes a bit more formal, doesn't he?
Yes, he's consul in 136 and 137, and Hadrian dies in 138. So he gets that important role. It's still an important role, the 2 years before Hadrian dies. And remember, the emperor is basically the person who decides who gets to be consul. So the fact that he's honouring him in this way in repeated years is a good sign.
And he also gives him his name.
Yes, he adopts him and gives him his own name. So Aelius, Lucius Aelius, Caesar, Caesar.
Mm.
That's a sure sign that you're the successor if you've got the emperor's name and the name Caesar as part of your name.
He was a strange choice, wasn't he?
Yes, he's a strange choice because he's not very healthy. And according to the, remember, very scurrilous Augustan history, his sole recommendation was his beauty. So he was good looking.
Yeah.
We all want that in an emperor. They really attack Hadrian for his attachment to Antinous. So I think that this is an extension of that, saying, oh, you know, he was in love with Antinous. And look, here's another good-looking boy who he favours.
I find it interesting that the Augustan histories actually give this man a chapter to himself. And it kind of gives the disclaimer that we're doing this to be complete, but even we don't really understand why we're doing it. They seem to spend most of the chapter saying that. It's only a few pages long. But one thing that I think... is kind of interesting is that it talks about how really wretched his health is. It gives him credit for living the high life and the luxurious life. And it says, he made a bed with four high cushions, closed in on all sides with fine net. This he used to fill with rose petals, from which the white part had been removed. And lying with his concubines, he used to cover himself, anointed with Persian perfumes, with a coverlet made of lilies. He liked the luxuries, and that seems to be the most redeeming feature that the Augustan histories could come up
with.
That's
not a redeeming feature. That would make him a terrible emperor if he indulges himself all the time.
I was using the word redeeming facetiously.
Okay.
So that's Hadrian's choice for successor.
Mm, yeah. He's not showing great judgment towards the end.
Luckily for Rome, he doesn't live to become emperor.
No. Hadrian's picked someone who has worse health than he does at this point. Hadrian seems quite bitter about this. This quote from the Augustan Histories where he says, "We have leaned against a tottering wall and have wasted the 400 million sesterces which we gave the populace and the soldiers on the adoption of this man."
So they threw a big party.
Indeed.
To
games,
and
money to the people. Yeah. To really build him up.
Yeah. That choice dies. And at this point, what does Hadrian decide?
This is very late in the day, by the way, because he dies right at the beginning of 138, and that's the year Hadrian's going to die. So what happens next happens fairly hurriedly. And early in 138, at the end of February, 25th of February, Hadrian adopts Antoninus, who will be the next emperor. And he does something which makes it look like he's hedging his bets a bit. He gets Antoninus, who we call Antoninus Pius, to adopt the emperor who will follow him, Marcus Annius Verus, who we call Marcus Aurelius, and Lucius, who is the son of Lucius Aelius, who's just died. So there are two possible ones coming after Antoninus. I think he's learnt his lesson here. He's learnt that he might nominate somebody and they might die. So you need the next generation in there too.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, I suppose, also making sure that your decision is going to affect Rome for years to come, that you've made the call on who's going to be emperor that far down the line.
Absolutely.
So at this point, Hadrian's finally made a decision that I was about to say that he can live with. He's finally made a decision.
He can die with.
Yeah. And he, I suppose, in some ways fulfills the curse.
Yes, he does, because he has a long lingering death and is said to have wanted to hasten his own death. Which, you know, there's not such a taboo on suicide in antiquity. He asks for the sword, he asks for poison, but apparently no one will help him. No one will listen and nobody will give him what he needs to end his life. He's supposed to have asked a man called Mastor, who was a captive, a barbarian, and was part of Hadrian's hunting entourage because he was very strong. He's supposed to have threatened him into promising to kill Hadrian. Evidently, he did not actually carry this out, but that's how desperate he's becoming. To go back to Anthony Burley again, he says that we know what was wrong with Hadrian from the description of his symptoms, and that is that he had degenerative heart disease. So he can hardly breathe at times. He has all kinds of health conditions that relate to that. And you imagine it's just a very sad, slow decline with nothing that can remedy it at the time.
So what do we know about the death of Hadrian?
So Hadrian eventually died on July the 10th, 138 CE. And Dio tells us, this is how we know the exact date, that he had lived 62 years, 5 months and 19 days and had been emperor 20 years and 11 months. It's a very Roman kind of, that they often have that on their tombstones, exactly how many years, months, days, sometimes hours they had lived. So he's not a young man when he dies, but he's not that elderly either. And as we say, he suffered towards the end.
I find it interesting. Well, we've said that the Augustan histories didn't think much of him, but it says at this point that Rome is glad that he is dead. But Dio also says the same thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, Dio gives us a more equivocal view, but he says at the end, Hadrian was hated. He was hated by the people in spite of his generally excellent reign, on account of the murders committed by him at the beginning and end of his reign, since they had been unjustly and impiously brought about. So Dio is much more balanced. He's saying it was a pretty good reign, but the people really didn't like him at the end because he had had these last few years of just lashing out at people. So, you know, all the good work from the Roman point of view that he'd done along the way sort of amounted to naught in terms of his reputation because of the last few years of really seemingly being angry and sad and ill, of course.
And is, petty.
Yeah, very petty in terms of especially characters like Apollodorus of Damascus, punishing them for really petty disagreements. He died at Baiae, which is one of the wealthy playgrounds of the Romans on the Bay of Naples, and he was buried nearby, initially at Puteoli, on an estate that Cicero had owned back in the day, what, nearly 200 years before. Later, he was put into the tomb of Augustus, which is a very appropriate space, of course, and then when his own mausoleum was completed, his remains were moved there. He left us his own epitaph. Okay, I think it's very beautiful. It's just 5 lines, but it is a poem. Little soul, little wanderer, little charmer, body's guest and companion, to what places will you set out for now? To darkling, cold and gloomy ones, and you won't make your usual jokes.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please give it a star rating or review on iTunes. It helps the podcast in the rankings and helps other people find it. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. That's it for Hadrian and for this episode of Emperors of Rome. So until the next one, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.